when the sky is high. No reason to stay on the ground. Lift your hands and you can touch and fly.
Hello and welcome to the second season of the Aviatrix Book Review interview series. I'm Liz Booker. I'm the host of the Aviatrix Book Club, the Aviatrix Book Review website, podcast, and YouTube channel, where I highlight and promote books that feature women in aviation. And you can find me at Literary Aviatrix on social media. We had a lot of new faces show up in the book club this month, which is so exciting. It brings a lot of new perspectives, a diversity of experiences, new connections and friends that we can make through this experience, and just a richer conversation overall. If you are new here, please check out all of the videos or podcasts that I did last year interviewing authors for all of the books, plus a few others. And if you have any interest in writing, please join us in the Aviatrix Writers Group and listen to the writers' portions of those interviews, where we talk about all things writing craft, publishing, and book promotion. A year into this project, I am still committed to producing both the interviews and the website without sponsorship or advertising. And what you can do to help support me is to subscribe and to leave a review, especially on whatever podcast medium that you're using. You can subscribe to me on YouTube. And then, as always, be sure to review the books you read to help support our authors, so that their books reach the broadest audience possible. My guest today is a former U.S. Navy helicopter pilot and retired Air Force colonel. She is the first and so far only Black woman to pilot the U-2 reconnaissance aircraft in its 66-year operational history. After retiring, she became a personal fitness trainer and participated in the second season of the reality television series Tough as Nails. Her book, Shatter the Sky, What Going to the Stratosphere Taught Me About Self-Worth, Sacrifice, and Discipline, is the Aviatrix Book Club discussion book for January 2022. You can check out an article I wrote about her for the January-February issue of Aviation for Women magazine on the Aviatrix Book Review website, and you can find her at her website, MerylTingsdahl.com, and on social media at DragonLady788. Meryl Tingsdahl, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me today.
You're welcome. You know how excited I am about this book because I have been stalking you for a year about it.
It's not that bad. You weren't that bad.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know what? I want to explain it a little bit because I did kind of track you down out of nowhere. I'm sure it felt like from your perspective. But one of the things that I was really trying to do is to build diversity into our reading list for the Aviatrix Book Club. Diversity of experience, diversity of types of flying, all of that stuff. But also diversity of race and culture and background. And when I went looking for books that featured women of color, no surprise, there just weren't that many. And just to kind of put it in perspective, when I was on active duty, I worked with the first female helicopter, female helicopter pilot in the Coast Guard. And this was in 2011. And she was a brand new pilot, so pretty junior to me. And so when I started this project, I kind of went through the Rolodex of Black female pilots that I had ever met in my life. And it wasn't very large, no surprise. And you were like the first one who came to mind because I randomly fangirled you at an Udvar-Hazy like Girls in Aviation Day and like came running up to you and asked you to take a picture with me. And so I was like, I wonder where she is in her life right now. I wonder if she's retired. And I was excited to find you online. And that's kind of how I tracked you down. And I was super excited when you said, well, as a matter of fact, I am writing a book.
Yes. I do remember Udvar-Hazy Center. That was a fun day because it's funny, like you fast forward. I mean, what was that 2010-11?
Yeah.
That we met. So I mean, Nicole Malachowski was there. And I distinctively remember her in a wheelchair with her husband, Thunderbird pilot. And I remember you showed me the picture. At first, I didn't remember your name, but you showed me the picture. I said, oh, yeah, I remember. And I remember the Girl Scout. It was a great time. It was great to be out there with a whole bunch of cool people and other pilots such as myself. So it was definitely fun.
Yeah, it was cool. And you know what? I'm just going to mention this, not related to your book or anything, but related to something that I said in my introduction about how the Aviatrix Book Club has had a lot of new faces. This month, I don't know if it's your book inspired a whole bunch of new people to join and join in the conversation. But last night we had a wonderful woman who is a docent at the Udvar-Hazy, which I think is totally cool. But that's a really cool place. So anyway, wow. So for those people who might not have had a chance to read the book yet, can you give us an overview of what it's about?
So the overview, it's a story about me, of course, memoir or autobiography. I'm still trying to figure out what the difference between those two are. And it's broken up into four parts. So it talks about me growing up in the Bronx, my Navy days, my Air Force days, and then how that all culminates into where I'm at now. And it just basically summarizes the person that I am and how I became to be this first, you know, one of the claim to fame in the military is the first Black woman to fly the U-2 spy plane. So I kind of get into that and kind of dive into my life story to just say, this is the type of person I am. And this is what drove me to be this pilot and eventually this person in the Air Force.
Well, I loved reading it. And I'm sure you had a million stories that you could have put in there, but I really liked the ones that you chose. I feel like you picked enough for us to really get a sense of your experience, both, you know, as a child, and then the Navy flying, which I can definitely relate to as a Coast Guard pilot. We went through very similar training. And then going on to the U-2 and the things that you've done since then. It's just a nice collection of vignettes, and it's told with a sense of humor. And I laughed out loud so much in this book. It just really is indicative of your personality in so many ways. And I also thought that the way it was written was super accessible. And what I mean by that is, like, you know, a younger person could totally read this, which I think was part of your goal. Why did you want to publish the book?
So, you know, full disclosure, when I was in the military, I had a couple of friends approach me, especially towards the end of my career, and say, hey, you need to write a book. People need to know about you. And quite frankly, I blew them off because I just wasn't ready. I wasn't in the headspace for that. I didn't think my story was very unique, but I mean, other people are telling me this. The way I view myself is not how others view me. I have a blind spot about myself in these terms, like bragging about myself. And it was only until I was interviewing for the show Tough as Nails, the CBS reality show, and I started thinking about, okay, as I was going through the interview process, I said, all right, as I need to start telling my story, because if this all goes well and I'm on TV, more people are going to want to know about me and how I became to be this pilot, and I think it's going to take off. So I started working with someone to write my story. The reason why I decided to do it in the way I did is, number one, we're going through a time of COVID, the pandemic. It started in, you know, 2020. And I think people felt a certain way. And you couple that with the racial tensions and the underlying tensions that had been going on and were coming to the surface. I just thought people needed a place or a book that they could read where it's coming from a real person and it was coming from a place of authenticity. I wasn't going to give them a very dry version of myself because that's not how I am. Most people who know me know I could be incredibly serious and intense at times, but the other times I like to have fun. I like to joke around, and I look at life a little differently. And I wanted to show people especially, you know, young girls of color, kids who feel like they've been dealt a bad hand and there's no way out for them, that they could look at my story and see this kid from the Bronx that had similar upbringings could become this incredibly successful person. So I wanted to make sure that they would read a story about that.
Speaking of you being a kid from the Bronx, you know, the closest I've gotten to the Bronx is through an author who was an advisor at Vermont College of Fine Arts, who is also a Bronx native. Her name is Ko Booth. I read these when I was in my master's degree program, Bronxwood, Kendra, and Tyrell. And they are all set right there in the Bronx. And it really gives me a sense of what that environment is like. And so maybe revisiting it through your lens, it kind of gave me a fuller picture of kind of what you were up against. You know, it doesn't sound like it's super easy to just navigate your way out of there, especially without strong role models, which it sounds like you did have when you were growing up. But tell me about living there and the perspective of someone who has lived many other places since.
So growing up there, you know, I grew up in Co-op City. And for those who live in the Bronx, they know where that's at. Co-op City is it's a lot of buildings that are tall, you know, single towers, double or triple towers. There's five sections to it. It was built on a place called Freedom Land, which was an amusement park back in the, I think in the 60s or 50s. So when they built Co-op City, my mother and father were the first in that apartment. And, you know, my mom owned that apartment for 50 years. So, you know, it was just like this next place of diversity. And in Co-op City, when I was growing up in the 70s, most of the people who lived there were either Black or Jewish. So I talk about, you know, watching, you know, listening to the older elders sitting on the bench speaking Yiddish or speaking Hebrew. Like a lot of my friends were Jewish. You know, my first party at 13 was a bat mitzvah, you know, so I'm very familiar with that. And, you know, it was that environment where, you know, that I talk about a woman who sat up by the window on the second floor and was watching the kids, and there was, you know, the village raising the child for real. Like if you did something wrong, you'd get in trouble. Not, you know, I think kids today, they're on the devices. They kind of do a lot of things that are, quite frankly, outside the boundaries of respectfulness. And, you know, some parents go, oh, well, or, you know, there was not this, I'm going to go tell your parent and have them take care of it. That's what happened when I was growing up. So, you know, I grew up in that environment.
Yeah, that was what was nice about living in military housing, I can say, is that we all kind of kept an eye on each other's kids that way. But it doesn't feel like you get that everywhere anymore.
No, that is definitely a lost art. And, you know, where I live, how it differs from now, I live in a place now that if a kid's doing something wrong, and you say that to a parent, there's a whole bunch of reasons why this kid is doing it, right? So there's a whole bunch of excuses made instead of like, okay, I'll handle it.
Right.
Unfortunately, I'm still the same parent. Like if you tell me my kid's acting up, I remember my daughter last week, oh, she did something. So it was really bad. We can't even get into it. I will just say that the psychologist called me from school and I was not happy. And this was, you know, last Thursday, I had a colonoscopy. So I was definitely coming out of, you know, the sedation, and I get this call and I'm like, are you kidding me right now? And I said to her, I picked her up and she goes, mommy, how was your day? And I looked at her, I go, oh, better than yours. Total silence. She just put her head down and just started walking. I said, yeah, we got a lot to talk about when we get home. So, yes.
Well, speaking of kids with spunk and maybe who got in trouble every once in a while, it sounds like you found your fair share.
I did. I did a lot of things. Some are written in the book. You know, I was a kid.
No, I was too. You actually fared better than I did during those years, to be honest. But so how was it for you to assimilate into the military culture?
So, I mean, as a kid, I definitely, you know, I definitely did some things that bordered on the criminal. But, you know, thank goodness there were some people. We'll talk about mentorship in a second. Some people who kept me on the straight and narrow. How was it assimilating into the military? So what I liked about the military is that you have a group of people for a goal. So I always wanted to be an astronaut. I knew I wanted to be a pilot. I knew I had to be a pilot as one stepping stone to being an astronaut. And what I liked about the military is that there's a sense of discipline. There's a sense of ownership. There's camaraderie there. Because we all go through the same stressful times. So, you know, you're working with a group of people from all different backgrounds, and you're working towards this common goal. It really is reminiscent of, you know, Star Trek in real life, right? So you have these military officers that are from this academy. They're working to explore. They're working on this mission, and they're working together. So I see you're smiling there. Like,
I know. Yeah. you're such a nerd. You and your track stuff. That's what I'm smiling about.
I am a nerd.
I know.
100%.
I love it. Yeah. Going back to, you know, I'm the same as you. I knew very early, at like by 5, that I wanted to be an astronaut. And I don't even know how I figured out that I had to be a pilot first. What made you believe that that was possible for you?
I think because no one told me I couldn't, you know, it was one of those. And even if they, you know, in the '70s, girls and boys had a specific role, right? So I write about that. When I was growing up, I had this little book to keep my report cards in. And on the back of it, it said, what do you want to be when you grow up? For girls, it was like secretary, mother. What was it? It wasn't airline hostess, or I forgot what it said. And on the boy's side, it said fireman, policeman, all these other military. And I just knew that was, you know, anything on the girl's side did not feel right. It was like, no, I don't want to do any of that. But, you know, being a policeman or a firefighter, people would make fun of me and say, oh, well, that's a guy's job. Why would you want to do that? And in my mind, I was like, you know, so what? That looks cool. Going into a fire to save people? Cool. Walking around arresting people that are bad? That's cool. Being in the military with with weapons is cool. Being a secretary, shuffling papers. Not cool. Like, it just.
And then you became an officer in the military and you were shuffling papers.
Absolutely. Yeah. NORAD, NORTHCOM. Oh, gosh. You know, there's nothing wrong with being a secretary. It's great. But I could see myself in a role of the action, not. Yeah, still, even today, it just doesn't do it for me.
Yeah.
9-to-5 jobs are not, they're not my thing.
So tell me about this path to Navy flight training. And I know you talk about it a little bit in the book, but you knew that the military was your best chance at being a pilot. Is that why you decided to join and pick the Navy?
Yes. Yeah, so when I went to college, I went into the electrical engineering program at University of New Haven. And I picked engineering because I knew that I wanted to be an engineer. It was going to be a fallback for me. It was also rigorous enough and interesting enough for me to do. I didn't pick aerospace or aeronautical because I just couldn't find the school with the program that I wanted. And I fell back to electrical because I had done some summer work working in electrical engineering in that field. So it was easy for me to do electrical. And I knew the courses that I would take would be, you know, they would translate into anything, aerospace or aeronautical. When I was in school, I did join Air Force ROTC for 2 years. It wasn't my thing. No offense to the Air Force. It just, the personality was not.
Says the retired Air Force colonel.
I know how we come full circle. It just wasn't for me. And the Navy just, I said, okay, I would like to be on a boat flying off the carrier. You know, Top Gun was out during that time in the 80s. What's not in the book is I talked to, and it's because I don't know if this made the book or we cut it out. There was in Co-op City, there was this officer that used to, they had patrol in Co-op City. They have their own kind of security. And there was this one retired cop who was part of security. His name, and I kid you not, was Officer Bacon. And him and I, we used to talk. When I come home from college, I would tell him, oh, you know, I don't know if I want to do the Air Force. I don't know if I want to do the Navy. ROTC won't guarantee me a flight spot. You know, I think I'm going to have to do direct commissioning. And he's like, well, why don't you do the Navy? They're better pilots. You know, he was like, his brother was a Navy person. I'm like, I'm not sure. So I would talk to him about this. And when after my second year in ROTC in the Air Force, and I said, no, this is not for me. You know, I started looking more towards the Navy. And that's my choice was solidified when I went down to Pensacola. I was dating a guy at the time that was graduating down there. He was a corpsman. And we were in Pensacola. And I went to the museum and I looked at all the astronauts on the wall and looked at all their backgrounds and found that a lot of the astronauts were naval aviators, at least there. And I said, OK, I'm going Navy. This is how it's going down. And that was really how I picked it.
That's so great. It's so great. Like, I honestly, well, you know, this isn't about me, but there's just so much like. Talking about full circle, I shared with you that I was a high school dropout, but I had done Navy junior ROTC in my first couple years of high school when I was at an aviation magnet school. And it was moving away from that was kind of why that was my demise, among other poor choices of my own making. But when I tried to enlist in the Navy first, and they wouldn't take me because it was the end of the first Gulf War. And so they were drawing down and I tried every other service. Navy was my first choice. And the Navy recruiter was the one who actually referred me to the Coast Guard recruiter, which was cool. Oh. And then I later found out that my grandmother was in the Coast Guard Reserve during World War II. I didn't even know that. So that's crazy. But then, you know, and then I find myself at Navy flight training, you know, later on. So I went through Whiting. You went to Pensacola, did your officer candidate school there. I love the story with your friend. Is her name Elizabeth too?
Yes, her name's Liz. Yes. Yeah,
she sounds fun. I want to meet her.
You know what? We're trying to do a Vegas trip. So, you know, I'll invite you out to Vegas. You can meet her. Yeah, we've been friends since we've met. So.
Well, that's how it happens in those environments, right? Like that's fast friendship in that scenario and the story that you guys share, both of you, because she has some writing in there too, which is fun. And then you went off to Corpus and flew the 234 there, and then you came back to Whiting for your TH-57 training, right?
Yes.
And then you went on to fly the 60.
I went to fly 60 Bravos East Coast. So which helicopter training squadron, HT-8 or 18?
18.
I was in 18.
Okay, that's cool. VT-2 in my primary, the Dewar Birds.
I was in VT-28.
Or as we like to joke, the DOR Birds.
That was a hard, I didn't stay at Pensacola because, it wasn't my first choice. I wanted to go to Corpus because I heard the course rules were easier. And I was like, yeah, I don't want to deal with
it. You know what? They probably were, because I'm pretty sure one of my downs was because of course rules. I couldn't recognize the damn chicken coop because there were like 18 of them and they all looked the same. So...
Yeah, they said, go to Corpus Christi. You just turn here and then go to the towards the water. I was like, all right, I'll do that.
Solid advice. So one of the scenarios that you talk about in the book, and, I think as pilots, we've all had these like moments with other pilots who do stupid things. But this guy who he was pilot in command,
yes,
and basically tries to fly in the water at night, yes, inadvertently. Talk about that a little bit. And then I have some things to say about that.
Right. So, this was when I had just gotten to HSL 48. And this was our first workup cycle. We were doing JTFX. I don't know if they still call it that. So joint force training exercises off of, I was on the USS Normandy. So we were flying off of the cruiser CG-60. And it was my first time as a helicopter second pilot. One of my first, training missions or training stuff out there off of Virginia. And it was a late night. We were doing a two bag. So we were flying about 7 hours. So two bags of gas, two bag flight. Or maybe it was one bag and it converted into a second bag. So we were going to go fly for 7 hours. It was probably around, 3 hours into the flight. And it was night. It was no moon. It was one of those dark nights. And we were playing sub games. We were searching for a sub. H-60s, anti-submarine warfare is one of the primary missions. And we know the sub is there. We have sonobuoys in the water. We know. I don't know if we went active on the sub, but we knew it was there, but we had to get a visual ID at nighttime. And I think drop a flare on it or something to say that, hey, we've actually got you, but we visually could not ID it. We were just having a hard time at that moment in the H-60s. We were just limited to night flying no lower than 200 feet, if I remember. And the reason why is because about a few months ago or a month or two ago, a crew went below 200 feet at night, and it was over the water, and they took a perfectly good aircraft and put it in the drink. They just put it in.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, ma'am.
Were you guys on night vision goggles?
No.
Okay.
Okay. So, MVGs, we weren't using MVGs at the time there. There was this big hole, a standard operation procedure change, SOP change, that no lower than 200 feet at night. And we know it's there. And the aircraft commander suggests that we can go below 200 feet at night if we're an, coupled approach. So the H-60, you could couple the approach and actually do, aircraft assisted approach to 50 feet and hover. So, okay. That's legit. It didn't say it in the rules, right? So I was like, okay. He's like, bring out the checklist and we'll go through the checklist. So as a 2P, I'm looking through the checklist. So we've all agreed. So it's myself, the pilot in command, and then the air crewman in the back. So it's three of us, which was mistake number one, right? So to agree to this. So I'm going through the checklist. And as I'm going through the checklist, I can't find it. I don't know why. I'm just fumbling through. I'm a 2P. I'm not that. I don't know what was my problem that night. But the more I couldn't find it, the more flustered I was getting. And the more I just couldn't search. Anyway, my head was down in the checklist. And unbeknownst to me, he started to do a manual descent. So the air crew member was strapped in, but he was looking outside the side doors looking for the sub. So he didn't feel, it was pitch black. He didn't know we were descending. And so it's taken me a while. And for some reason, I feel a little bump on the aircraft and it didn't feel right. And I look up and, you know, of course, the first thing you look up is the altimeter. I don't know about you, but I do. And we're descending through 20 feet. And
I kind of want to puke just thinking about that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you, the pit in your stomach when you know, this, it's about to go down. And I just remember yelling power, and I grabbed the collective and I pulled an arm, you know, I pulled hard and, you know, I got under controls. And the air crew member, he actually put his head back in and he said we were at 6 feet because he hasn't, you know, rat out in the back. And we started climbing away and it was just total quiet in the cockpit. And we were, you know, needless to say, I mean, that was a scary moment because, you know, just before we deployed, you know, we had that crew that took a perfectly good aircraft and put it in the water, stand up and tell us, you know, in the Navy, when you make mistakes, you're telling everyone about it. So, and it's not as punishment, but that's part of your accountability for the most part, at least back then when I was going through. So it was a very quiet aircraft for the remainder of our mission. And even when we got back, I think we were just all shooken up. We did not debrief. Like, it was one of those, like, we're going to bed. Good night. And, you know, for me, it was a lot of lessons learned about this particular individual, the way he conducted, you know, how we all conducted cockpit resource management, because it's not just him. But for me as a 2P, I learned a lot on that sortie. So, you know, it just stuck with me forever. And that's how I conducted myself.
What's the joke about the Navy and the Air Force where it's, if you're in the Navy and it doesn't say anything about it in the regs, then you can do it. And in the Air Force, if it doesn't say anything about it in the regs, you can't do it. Have you ever heard that? So, how does that go?
Yes, of course. Yeah. The saying is the Air Force tells you what you can do. The Navy tells you what you can't do.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a small nuance, but it's very important because, you know, I came with the assumption, especially when I went in, when I became a Navy instructor at Moody Air Force Base, I thought that the Navy and the Air Force train their pilots the same, but they don't. There's definitely, it's not a good or bad thing. I think all pilots in the Navy and the Air Force are good pilots, you know, great pilots. They do really well, but the thought process, there's a small nuance about that. I think Navy pilots, you know, they just have more maneuvering room to do things. But with that comes a lot of responsibility. And if you make an error, you better be ready to talk to your peers. You know, you're going to sit at the long end of that table explaining yourself. In the Air Force, you can always look for a higher authority to give you permission. You're always looking for permission so you don't have to assume that responsibility. Well, that's great and all, but when it comes to leadership, eventually you're that higher authority. So you have to be able to make those decisions on your own. And I think the Navy starts you out earlier, but they hold you accountable for it. So I love that the Navy does that because I think as an officer going into the Air Force, I was just more mature in that way. And I was willing to make decisions that would make people feel uncomfortable or maybe not in their comfort zone for my other peers, my Air Force peers. But I knew how to stand my own ground and I knew how to defend myself. And I was more confident as a result of that.
You know, speaking of accountability, the question that I had was, what happened after that flight? Did you report that incident to the safety officer? What went on? I was confused about the after.
Right. So the after, we never talked about it.
Wow.
We never reported it. Yep. Bad on us. We never reported it. We never talked about it. It was one of those things that what happened on the ship stayed on the ship.
Well, I can tell you, I saw so many people have that bite them in the ass because, you know, there are three of you in that plane. Right. and somebody's going to run their mouth at some point. And so it's really interesting, the culture and how it's evolved, you know, over the years. It was still evolving in the Coast Guard at the time from sort of the previous sort of cowboy-ish culture to a more safety conscious environment. So I could totally see it.
Right. So it was one of those that you just didn't talk about. There are a lot of things that happen on the ship that don't get talked about. And I'm not saying is it a good or bad thing? It depends on what it is.
Yeah.
I mean, that was definitely a lesson learned for us. Like I carried that with me. I mean, even to this day, I mean, I conducted myself, I did not put my trust into the aircraft commander. You know, as a new helicopter second pilot, I realized that my knowledge and my worth was a lot more, and I need to speak up, because if I didn't at that point, we would have been, again, another crew talking about what happened. And
you were lucky.
Yeah, incredibly lucky. There's nothing else to say about that. It wasn't just luck. I'm thankful that I looked up at the moment that I did. Yeah. I knew something wasn't right. I can't explain anything more about that. So I'd rather be in that point. I'd rather be lucky than good any day. Because once we hit the water, being good. Oh. Yeah, I think we would have died. I knew my air crewman would have died because he was outside of his seat. Imagine that thing going upside down.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. Anyway. Well, you know what? Even the civilian pilots, that story resonated with them in terms of like flying with different people and how much you count on the other person in the other seat, regardless of their supposed, vast experience or whatever. You always got to be on your game when you're at the controls of a plane. So
100%.
Yeah. But we're talking about crews with more than one pilot, and you have a lot of experience doing it all on your own, which is crazy to me. But I want to talk a little bit about how you got there first. I appreciated that you shared some of the challenging experiences that you had, including this one, you know, with the over the water incident, but then also just sort of the interpersonal issues and people maybe targeting you, and maybe you don't know why that's happening or what's the motivation behind it, but it's happening nonetheless. And that was an incident that I think kind of helped get you to a new opportunity, which is neat. Is that how you would describe that?
So are we talking about, when I was in the Navy and just the whole, right? So, I will preface this with, during that time and I talk about it during the book, during that time in the Navy, the H-60 community, our squadron was highly competitive, which like most, very competitive. There were two women. There was myself. No, there were three or four women in that squadron. We flew off of small ships. So small ships definitely have a very competitive nature. It's a dog eat dog nature. And so I was definitely that type of person that I could be abrupt. My personality was one of aggression. I was young. I was hungry. And, I did not make qualms about, I was comfortable with conflict. I will say that. Right. So you have to be, because in this environment, because it's so competitive.
Yeah. You can't survive with that kind of competition unless you're able to hold your ground. Yeah.
Right. So, conflict is something that you want a piece of me. Let's go. Let's take it outside. Like I was ready all the time. So, that kind of wears on you. And maybe some of that was because of my personality, but I also knew that even though I might be comfortable with conflict, I was also highly competent and very good at what I did. I knew I was an aircraft commander, still as a Lieutenant JG. So, you know, I knew I was very good at what I did. And I knew that could be threatening for some people, especially as a woman in a squadron. Now, was that the reason? I don't know. You never really know. You can only find facts on a lot of things and cross things off. And eventually you start getting into, oh, is it the gender thing? Is it the race thing? Is it the personality thing? You just keep going. So I will say some of it might have been personality, but I think some of it was gender. I think some of it was race. And part of the personality part of it is I was in conflict with my OIC officer in charge of my second deployment. Him and I got into it quite a bit on the boat. And when we got off the boat, again, what happens as he stays at sea, right? You'll hear that a lot. And a lot of things that happened with us stayed there because I was that type of person that I wasn't going to air dirty laundry of the dead. It just wasn't my thing. But I think that came kind of full circle because I worked for him at the squadron and he was able to do things and create this narrative about me, which was not necessarily 100% true. So was he mad at me? Probably. Could he get at me because of my abilities? No, but he could paint a narrative. And that's what people do. So it affected me and it affected my performance report. Yeah. That's just bottom line. So I knew not having a good performance report coming out of my sea tour, I knew that was going to affect me for test pilot school and anything future on. So I knew that was that could be a potential showstopper. But fortunately, I had some mentors and I told them my desires to, you know, do something maybe more joint working with the Air Force because I was curious how the Air Force did their policy and did their stuff. And my friend came through. So I was very grateful for him to give me that opportunity. And I was really grateful that my boss at the time was so arrogant and he believed anything that I said. And I was able to kind of downplay the job that I eventually got was instructor flying the T-6. And because I think if I had told him, he probably would have done something to stop that.
That was a good play on your part, by the way.
Yes. You know, we talked about my friend Liz, and when she read that part, we spoke about it. And she said to me, she said, "Meryl, I remember that when you called me," because I would confide in her. And she said to me, she was like, "That was the first time you did not know what to do." Like she said, "Meryl, you saw the writing on the wall. You knew what was happening. And you told me, you like, Liz, I have no idea what the next move is. I don't have another move. Like yeah. I can't confide in anyone at the squadron. I couldn't confide in my commander. All I had was one guy who was a detailer, who was my mentor, who I was talking to, and he believed me. And I was like, hey, you know, I could be difficult, but this stuff is going on is out of bounds. I'm getting screwed. So yeah, he was able to help me.
Well, now that you've started talking about that, you know, you talk about it at this moment in the book and then in future moments. And I know that I couldn't have survived as long as I did in the Coast Guard without having people here and there that I could reach out to who trusted me, who believed in me and were willing to invest in me. Even when I was in the middle of a shit storm, wherever I happened to be, that I couldn't see my way out of. So the same kind of stuff. I mean, you want to talk more about that mentoring that you received, mentoring that you chose to pay forward, and how that impacted your life?
Right. So, you know, mentoring is a constant fluid cycle, right? You're helping other people, mentoring people, people are mentoring you. You always have to keep that going, right? And I say in the book, if you're not mentoring, you're wrong. And because there are people you know, for me in the Navy, I had this one person who, you know, he flew with me. He was my, he was an instructor of mine. He was a friend of mine. He was also a man of color, and he had seen before me the things that go on in the squadron. And he calls, no pun intended, he calls a spade, like he calls the truth, and he could tell by how I was describing the situation that this was kind of a setup, and he was able to help. He knew he couldn't help me in that moment, but he knew what other outlets, how can I get you to move on? He was able to set up an appointment with, or not appointment, an interview with me, with the commander at the FRS Fleet Replacement Squadron, or what people remember as the, you know, the RAG, as they called it. I don't know if they still call it that, to be an instructor in the H-60. And he, and the commander did want me to go there. But then this other opportunity came up. So my friend was, you know, definitely in my corner to help me do that. But yeah, mentorship is key. I tell people now in the military, it's not about finding someone who looks like you, who, you know, it's about, or, you know, looks like you in any way. It's about someone who's aligned with what you're doing. And for me, that's, those are the people who I found in my life, whether it was as a kid finding Miss Harriet, who gave me Star Trek books to, you know, feed my curiosity and feed my obsession with Star Trek, to, you know, General Shanahan, who retired as a 3-star, who didn't know me from anything. All he saw was my record and asked the question, why is a Black female who has a line number to colonel getting out of the military? I want to talk to her. I want to figure out who she is. And through that, he started mentoring me. He went to the Pentagon. He started doing those things. So he liked the person that I was. He liked the person I was on paper and then got to know me. And so it's just about finding people who are in your corner. And yeah, who are aligned with you, who walk in the same direction as you. So that's what I tell people. And when I mentor people, I don't care what you look like. I don't care if you're ethnicity. I want to know, do you have goals? Are you hungry? Can you persevere through the tough times? Can you get up when you fail or get kicked? And, you know, how can I help you make those connections? And if I could do that, yeah, I'll do it.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, there's this thing about affinity, you know, that we talked about, at least when I was on active duty, we had affinity groups, this, that, and the other thing. But the word affinity, I feel like it played a lot in my experience, in watching the way that mentorship relationships developed or started. And I guess what I'm getting at is that, you know, you can be someone senior and look closely across the board and make sure that you're reaching out equally or as appropriate to the people who need you. But as a junior person, it's harder to identify who among the group, if nobody does look like you, is going to be supportive of you. Because people don't naturally, and the example I use is flight school. I was an alien at flight school. I mean, I was prior enlisted. I was a woman. I was a mother. You know, I had been in for 6 or 7 years or 5 or 6 years at that point. And those guys didn't know what to do with me. They knew what to do with my male peers who were single and who were down at Seville Quarter every weekend. They understood how to connect with them, but they didn't know how to connect with me. And I think that that's, you know, I feel feel for people who, like me in that situation, don't know where to look. You know what I mean?
I understand that that's hard. Like, yes, that is hard. I had, when I worked in the physiological support detachment on the Air Force side, there was an Air Force, tech sergeant. He got picked up by the Navy for flight school. And he was a family man. He was an artist. And he was going to go to OCS. And I told him, when you go to flight school, you're going to be the old guy with kids. And you're going to be, you know, you're going to be the one. You're not hanging out. You're not drinking the whole time. And I told him, I said, that's okay. Play with your kids. Have fun. Enjoy the time off that you're going to have when you're either at Corpus. I said, go to Corpus. Don't go to Pensacola. Those course rules kill you. And I said, and I told him, you know, there might be a few families there, but, you know, you might, you know, you and your wife have to be that team with each other. Right. So for single parent, you know, single parents, that's going to be difficult. But I will say, for example, when I was, I'll give you another example. When I was at NORAD Northcom, I felt, when I was there, I felt alone in terms of, you know, people were at the staff tour who had sponsorship there. And when I say sponsorship, people who got those by name requests to get them there. And here I am coming in. I don't know how I got these orders. All I knew, I was trying to be a squeaky wheel because I was coming from a command job at Palmdale where no one was really looking at me. And I remember saying to myself, I don't know what I'm going to do next. And what I started doing is I started making appointments for mentorship with random people in the building, like for the J5. I worked for him momentarily till I got kicked over to J8, and I made, yeah, I'm that crazy.
You did the rounds at the joint staff.
I did the rounds. Like that was when I talked to General Scobie out there. I met Dr. Croach, who was one of the highest civilians there. She saw me in the hallway. Like, I started just popping up on people's calendars. Hey, sir, can you give me some mentorship? And because I didn't know what to do.
Yeah.
And he's like, and I remember, I don't even remember the J5's name. You know, he's a 2-star. And I was like, sir, I need some help. I need some mentorship. Can I come to you if I need some help? And he's like, I don't know. And I'm like, okay, thanks. And then next I'm with General Scobie. Hey, sir.
That's awesome.
I did that at the Pentagon also. I would just show up to people's offices. I roll up in there. And people like, can I help you? I'm like, no, I'm just looking around. Hey, this is the AA. Oh, Ms. Z works here. Oh, can I get an appointment with your deputy? And they're like, why? I'm like, I don't know. I just want to talk. That's what I would do. That's as simple as it was. And I started becoming known around the building. Same at NORAD Northcom. I just started.
Well. It's a good strategy, I guess. It takes some confidence to be able to do that. Probably a little easier when you're a little more senior.
It is, but I was a major at NORAD Northcom. No, I'm sorry. I was a lieutenant colonel.
Yeah.
So when you're a little senior, but I kept thinking in my mind, I know this is crazy, but what do I have to lose? I don't have a mentor anyway. So sometimes people don't remember what you did, but they'll just remember you. Oh, I saw her before. I don't know where, but I know her.
She was loafing in the office. So I don't know why. She was
just walking around. So
that's so great.
I don't know if that's a great strategy, but when you have nothing else to lose, why not?
Yeah. You know what? I love telling the story about this one woman who is a good friend of mine now, but she was a couple of ranks junior to me. She was off on her own in Puerto Rico. She was feeling isolated and she just cold called me one day and said, "Will you be my mentor?" And I was like, "Okay." She was like, "By the way, they call me Squirrel." And and I was like, "Okay." And then we ended up being stationed together in Los Angeles, and we're good friends now. But yeah, I had to admire her for just like looking anywhere, especially when she was feeling isolated, for whatever support that she could get. And I gave it to her. So
yes. Yeah. I think as I moved up the ladder and I got to meet more one stars, two stars. I mean, these are just normal people who they too are looking for the next thing and looking around, and some of them are uncomfortable. I remember once General Shanahan and I talked when he went to the Pentagon and I was there. I would get on his calendar and we would just go to the executive lounge, or not executive lounge, but the executive lunch area, because there were several in the building, and we would just talk. We would just talk about random stuff, and I just realized he's just this cool guy.
Yeah, I had the good fortune to work in some joint environments as well, Jai out of South, and then as the SDO working for Southcom out of Barbados, and I had similar experiences where. I was someone who, you talked about being feisty. There was nothing that brought me more joy than to find a bully Army 06 who was like trying to tear people down and to pick a fight with him. Like that brought me joy. I would actually go seek it, when I was bored. But for the most part, like the flags were, you know, there were some who were like just super brainiac, hyper-focused. And then there were others who were just people, you know, and right. Thinking about what's next for themselves. So I was fortunate to have those kinds of mentorship experiences as well. Not enough to get me to 06, but to 05 from an E1. So I'm very grateful for that.
That's you're a Mustang. I mean, Mustangs are... They're like unicorns, man. You know, I mean, it's meeting a Mustang is an awesome thing.
So speaking of unicorns, Dragon Lady, we have to talk about this U2 because that's your claim to fame. And I've got my Dragon Lady t-shirt on, which I wear to the gym all the time. And it gives me like that extra spunk. So like I really get a great workout when I'm wearing it. But so you transitioned to the Air Force. Yes. And you did this whole selection process for this crazy aircraft. It's just insane that that thing actually flies, that it's been flying for 66 years, and that you flew around in it. So tell me all about that.
Yeah, the U-2. I mean, U-2 Dragon Lady. It's, you know, the pilots, the brotherhood, the sisterhood of the U-2 is great. You have to be a little not quite right to fly that aircraft because it's single seat. It flies like a plane up at altitude, but down below, you're fighting that thing to land it. I mean, because, you know, with wings like that, she doesn't want to land. Bicycle gear configuration, she doesn't want to land.
You know, so. You talk a lot about the landing, but somebody mentioned they were describing what the takeoff is like. And I don't remember you doing that, but what is it like? Like, how does it balance on those little wheels to take off? Like, how does that work?
So you have the outriggers,
which are what?
So when the U-2 is flying, so it's a bicycle landing gear configuration. You have a main gear in front. You have a tail wheel in the back. On the sides of the wings, you have these things called tail wheels. So they're outriggers. They help the aircraft when you're taxiing it in and out. Before takeoff, there's some pins to keep the tail wheels in. Once those pins are out for takeoff, as the aircraft is going along the runway, as wings pick up speed, wings flex upwards. So when they flex upwards, they're not tail wheels, they're called pogos. the outriggers drop off. I call them tail wheels in the beginning, but they're small wheels. We call them pogos. They
Someone
drop off.
Described them as like training wheels for the wings.
They are, but they're just used to help the aircraft taxi.
Yeah.
Because okay. Again, you have the bicycle landing gear configuration. If you didn't, unless you have a, you know, a great fuel balance, the one of the wings are going to drop. So
yeah,
that's not. So the pogos are just there for taxiing. Once you take off, in theory, the pogos should drop off once the wings flex up when you have enough airspeed over for takeoff.
Crazy. Okay.
So I've never had a situation where a pogo has stayed on the wing after takeoff, but you can have a hung pogo situation. But basically you gotta be careful because now it's, you know, a wheel that could drop off at any moment. So again, you're flying over houses. Don't do it. You know, you got to go somewhere and try to come back for, you know, a low approach to see if you can dislodge it. No, you don't rock the wings because there's a warning for that. Someone died doing that. So you have to just be, yeah. Yes. The hung pogo could be a, you know, it's pretty benign. Just don't make it worse than it is.
Well, hello again, Meryl.
It's great to be back. I wore the same shirt again. So I just wanted to make sure there was no, did you wear the same thing?
I did not. It's dirty. I wore it to the gym the day after we talked.
I just want to let you know that there's this thing called a washing machine.
Yeah, I get to that every once in a while when I get to my housewife duties, as you call them, apparently.
Yes. Well, I say I got housewife-ish to do, but we won't curse on here.
That'll piss my husband off because he does most of the laundry around here anyway. So
my husband, that's a podcast for another day.
I know.
The husbands of very strong women in life.
Yes. Actually, we will get to a little bit of that. But when we left off the other day, we were talking about taking off in the U2. We were getting ready to talk about flying the plane. We finally got there after talking about all of this sort of, you know, how you deal with conflict in your squadron and mentors and all of that, flying the helicopter and all that great stuff. So now we finally get to the U2, your claim to fame. And I had questions about how to take off. And you kind of explain those, but what else should we know? I mean, you definitely describe it really well in the book.
Thank you.
But what should we know about the U2 that's also unique?
What's unique? I mean, it's a single seat aircraft. So, you're not really talking to anyone. You could talk to someone on the radios, you know, occasionally if you want to, but you don't. So you have to have this mental strength of being able to be comfortable with yourself. And I think it's funny because during COVID, like when everything locked down, I was in my happy place. I was like, oh, okay. Get to do stuff. I did get to do videos, but it seemed like a lot of people were not comfortable with themselves. And I found that interesting. People, you know, a lot of mental health things started coming up and it's just like, you know, you're your best advocate. So get to know them.
You know, that's so interesting that you experienced it that way. I consider myself like a borderline introvert extrovert. So okay. I can put on a show, I can do the extrovert stuff, but then I need to recharge. I don't like get energy from that. It drains me. But I was like, woof, those flights all by yourself up there. Like, I don't know if I could handle that. But when you're talking about COVID, you know, I set my life up when I retired so that, you know, I had my day to myself to work. I had the house. I set up a battle rhythm as soon as I retired. 0500, go to the gym, you know, cleanups, everything, like just like you would on a ship so that I would be disciplined. And then when COVID happened, I was surrounded by people. They were like making a mess everywhere and it drove me crazy. So
yes. So, you know, I hear that because, you know, I have two young urchins that I call them, lovingly call them. And when COVID hit, you know, we started fostering was our first foster during that time. And it was a challenge, but what my husband and I did, we maintained a battle rhythm. Every morning they'd get up at a certain time. We'd all get dressed. We'd all do stuff. I was, I would do like this 3-2-1 workout just to start the day. 3 minutes of cardio, 2 minutes of strength, and 1 minute of abs to just get it going. I post it just because some people were in a rut. They'd stay in their pajamas all day, and I didn't understand that. So yeah, the rhythm was messed up by the family being there, but you started a new battle rhythm. So I feel that probably most military people were able to weather the storm better than civilians, just because, when you're deployed and you're on a ship, I remember seeing a meme with Kermit the Frog. I don't know if you posted it or something.
No, I didn't post it. I think we're thinking about the same thing.
Yeah, it's like COVID with civilians, and his hands are waving in the air all frantic, and then like they're like military people, and he's sitting back on the couch with a cup of coffee, just chilling, just being in his happy spot. So yeah, it wasn't that much of a change. Except I did a reality show during COVID, but that was something. That was something unique. That was a one-off.
Oh my gosh! And we have to talk about that too. Okay. But we just got off on this tangent because you were so isolated in the aircraft, and yeah. I find that I don't know. I guess you get comfortable in the thing that you get proficient at, but I feel like that's a really long time to be alone.
Yeah, it's only over 8 hours. I mean, what's the big deal? So you get to talk to people. I mean, you're doing the mission. You're checking sensors. You're talking to other people. You're talking to ground troops. You're trying to figure out the battlefield, how you can best be placed, and talk about where you're most suited as an asset. So there are things going on, but there's transit time that could take a few hours. And, you draw, read.
Really? I know you said that you were reading the magazine when you're flying, and I'm like, whoa.
Yeah.
Solo?
Yes. I mean, there's an autopilot. So you just, oh, Jack LaLanne. He invented the Smith machine. Oh, okay. Cool.
Oh, man. That's crazy. And then you talked about the sort of physiological pressures that it put on your body and some of the long-term damage that you may be experiencing because of it, that other pilots have experienced. But then we were on a call, you were talking about, you talk about it.
Right. So, I mean, at the time I was flying the U-2, the cabin pressure was set at about 29,000 feet approximately. So for all those who don't, let me paint a better picture. It's like being at the top of Mount Everest and you're breathing 100% oxygen, but your body's feeling that physiological effect. So you are exposed to quite a few things. You can get DCS, decompression sickness. So in the form of the bends or the chokes, for divers understand that, or you could get neurological damage because you have these bubbles moving around in your body. And for some reason, depending on the day, if you have enough, hydration, if you're tired, all these factors, all these little things factor into it, right? So for us, for you two pilots, what you have to do before you fly a high flight, you have to breathe 100% oxygen before takeoff, 1 hour before takeoff. And the reason why you do that is because your tissues love 100% oxygen. So what it will do is replace any nitrogen that's in your body with that 100% oxygen. So basically you're like off-gassing, when you get a new piece of furniture and it smells like plastic and it off-gasses after a while and it smells like your house. And so that's what we would do, but still it helps minimize that. But I guess during the time that I was flying, a lot of us had experienced more severe symptoms of DCS. And again, some of my friends got it very badly. During that time, we almost had a Class A mishap, which means for those who don't know, Class A is, I think the rules were, the cut line was over $1 million worth of damage that might have changed since then, and permanent brain damage or loss of life. Right. Yeah. So we had a gentleman who and it's documented that experienced DCS, you know, through the flight, but he cleared the symptoms, and there was some ambiguity of, do you continue a mission if you have some DCS? Like, he felt joint pain, he felt better, he inflated the suit, but then he continued on, and then it started to progress in a dangerous way. So he had neurological damage, and he almost crashed the aircraft, but he luckily landed. It's a great story. If those out there,
it's intense.
Just hearing him tell it, his name is Kevin Henry, a great guy, great pilot. But he suffered that, and he had to go through a lot of, I'll say, therapy, for lack of a better term right now, to kind of get back to some sort of normal. And then he was probably the most severe, but we had another guy who had other issues. Other people were just having issues. So they did a study during the time I was there, and they found that most of us had these white spots or brain lesions. So, you know, I participated in the study because I was curious. You know, who doesn't want to see what their brain looks like? So,
yeah,
so I found out. So we don't know the long-term implications. We just know that maybe something will happen, something may not happen. Yeah.
Wow.
That's okay.
So since then, you talked about how the plane has been reconfigured, right?
Right. It's been modified. They actually changed the structure. So the cabin altitude now at 15,000. So that happened. That happened right as I was leaving as the commander at Palmdale. So we were in talks to get that done. And I think they started retrofitting the aircraft right shortly before I left. So that was in 2010. So when I got back in 2013, most of the aircraft were, the single seat aircraft were at 15,000 feet, which it made a difference. I mean, when you fly U2, so our missions were, you'd fly once and then you would, the next day had to be a down day. So you were doing no activities. The following day was a ground duty only, and then you were eligible for a flight. So we flew once every 3 days because it makes you tired. Our rotations when we deployed were typically somewhere between 60, no more than 90 days, just because of how tired you get flying the line consistently. Yeah. So it takes a toll on you, but I'd do it all over again.
That's awesome. I was just thinking, you know, if we had a listener out there, a young person who was interested in being a U2 pilot, your path to that was very unique, but you were around other pilots who took different paths. What advice would you give a young person if, like, that's their one dream in life is to fly the U2? How would they do that?
So I would definitely, you know, join the Air Force. That would be the goal, right? So, because the U2 is only flown by the Air Force. If you want to go another branch of service, you could do the way I did, but you're still spending like 12 years in that service and then you're doing an inter-service transfer. But you start off, I know the Air Force is starting a program right now in UPT where one student per year, if they get selected, could go directly to the U2 program. So they're trying to take a person right out of training and put them in the U2. So I was in touch with one person who is, it's a pilot program that they're starting, no pun intended. But I was in touch with the person that's coming out here that is just done with UPT. He's going to start flying T-38s and go to the U2. So we'll see what happens.
Wow.
And if that works, then there'll be students, a few selected students who can bypass the interview process. If that doesn't happen, what you have to do is pick an aircraft, and there's, you know, you need X amount of hours. I don't remember. There's a website. Beale has the U2 application website on there. I think at the time that I applied, you needed, I don't know if you needed about 1,500 hours or maybe it was 2,000 hours and 1,000 instructor hours. You needed both instructor and flight time. So you had to be pretty experienced to apply for the program. So that's what I would say. You're frowning.
That's very interesting. That is there's a wide delta between somebody who has thousands of hours and has been an instructor and somebody's straight out of flight training.
Yeah.
Like, what do you think about all of that?
I think it's going to be interesting. It depends on the person, right? So some people, you know, they get to the U2 program, T38s, maybe they have a little bit more of a challenging time than the U2. Because we fly the T38 as a companion trainer. But I just think it'll be interesting. We have to see who the student caliber is. I think there might be a learning curve there. And it depends on the person and how much they want it, how much effort they're going to put. They may change up the curriculum for this person and give them additional flights to get them up to speed. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, that's interesting and exciting for those young people who are who really want to do it and get the opportunity. I hope you do well.
Right. So I think, don't quote me on this, I'm not sure, I'd have to check with my friend, but I think they still have to interview and still do 3 flights in the U2. So part of the interview process is flying the U2. So you do 3 flights. And if you are trainable, they'll hire you on. They'll say, hey, are you interested in being a part of it? If not, they'll say thanks, but no thanks. So, you know, it's a 2-week process.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we'll see.
How did yours go? What was the hardest part for you?
The interviews with the commanders and stuff went well. I'm almost sure I tell about the story when I talked to the director of operations for the training flight, about the jar of Vaseline on his desk. Did I? No, I didn't.
That one is not standing out to me. Please.
Okay. Quick story during my interview.
It might be in there, but I don't remember that one.
Yeah. I don't know if it got taken out, but I've told the story before. So quick story during my interview process, you have to talk to the commanders of the 99th and the 1RS. The 1RS is the training squad. So the commander of the 1RS wasn't there. So I talked to the DO, director of operations, second in charge. And I walk in and I'm in my dress blues in the Navy, everything. You know, I'm looking really, you know, spiffy, very professional. And I'm sitting there and we're having a conversation. It's going well. But I'm looking around his office, like I'm just looking at the pictures on his wall. I'm looking at his desk. I'm just checking it out. And what I notice is this huge jar of Vaseline on his desk. It's just sitting there. And I'm like, it's a little interesting. So we're done with the conversation. And he goes, well, Merrill, you know, nice to meet you. Do you have any other questions? And I go, and I start getting a serious face. I go, sir, I have a question. It's been bothering me for this, you know, since I've been here, since I came in your office. And I really want to know. And, you know, I'm not sure how to say this or anything. And I look concerned. So he starts leaning in because he's like, well, what's wrong? What's going on? And I go, well, what's up with the jar of Vaseline on your desk? And he just stops. He goes, what? And I go, what's up? And he goes, well, puts on the tap dance shoes and starts dancing. And I just have this smile, cracked a smile like,
he had no good reason for that to be there. He couldn't come up with anything.
He was just like, well, you know, sometimes, you know, the guys are playing the joke and, I don't remember what he said, but he was tap dancing. And I said, okay, sir, thanks. And I got up and left.
I thought for sure that was going to end with, well, you know, when we fly the U2 and we put the suit on, we need Vaseline to lube up. He had nothing.
I totally caught him. I caught him flat footed. And then he told me later on, he goes, at that moment, I knew you were perfect in this squad. Because I had them all leaning in ready, like to give me some mentorship and to be all great. And I'm like, yeah, what's up with that jar?
That's so great.
So
that's your sea time right there in your Brooklyn.
Bronx.
And your Bronx. I'm a terrible person.
But no, it was... you know,
that's so good.
Yes. So I always tell people the U2 is the people there landed are not quite right. Like there's good camaraderie, good sense of humor, you know, slightly raunchy, not over the line, but it's fun.
I tell everybody, and I don't even know if I've said, I tell everybody, well, I actually, when I reported to the Joint Command and I had like this crew of, they were mixed military and civilians, most of them were prior military.
all men, of course. And I was going to be in charge of these guys. And I was just like, listen, I grew up in the adolescent boys' locker room. I have pretty high tolerance. Some things will cross a line and you'll know when they do.
Yes. Look, I mean, you know, I mean, I was raised in officer candidate school when the drill instructors were telling us to get together nut to butt. I mean, this is how, like some people now may be offended, but it was very crude. It was very direct. And you understood. Okay. And then the drill instructors had the nerve, like if there was a girl with a boy tight like that, they would come in and put their hands in between us to make some more spacing. I was like, this place is.
Yeah. You just kind of get like indoctrinated into the culture, into the boys' locker room culture. And at some point you just have to assimilate for the most part to survive. So you and I think are pretty similar. I too have a sense of humor about a lot of it, as long as it's not, you know, directed at humiliating somebody or, right. You know what I mean?
Right. So, my mind could go in the gutter, but you know, you have to know your audience, right? So you have to. In the military, there are some people who maybe didn't have that upbringing, and that's okay. They just need to be comfortable in the environment. And the moment you start making someone feel like an outsider, then you've crossed the line and you got to make it right. So, you know, if you slip up, I think a lot of people have that. Some people have that, you know, response like, well, they need to toughen up and have thicker skin. It's like, no, you need to kind of just dial it back when they're around because
maybe elevate the maturity level of our interactions just a touch.
But I
it up a little bit.
just be a little more classy. And then when you're with the other people, you can say what you want, within reason. That doesn't cross the line. But I being on the boat, being with the Navy, I was a sailor first. So yeah, I have a mouth. I have my mind could go in the gutter. This is just, I can hang with the best of them. I mean, there's a point that I talk about it in my first deployment, you know, all the guys had all these, you know, Playboy magazines and, you know, naked pictures. And there's a point where I like, dude, this does not interest me and it's annoying. So, you know, my way to combat that was, okay, I have a Playgirl.
Yeah. I thought that was great.
You like to see boobs? I like to see other swinging things. How about that? And they're like, oh no, we don't want to see that. I'm like, why are you so sensitive now? Oh, does this bother you? Well, too bad.
I love it. Those are such good stories. So great. Cracks me up. And I love that you were able to have a sense of humor about those things and you didn't let them shut you down. Not everybody responds that way. And you know, it's an evolving culture always.
It is. And again, for those people who don't take that avenue, you know, just be you and say something.
And set your boundaries, right?
Yeah, right.
And people in leadership positions can set the tone too. So
absolutely.
Right.
Yes.
Not my problem anymore, but definitely thought a lot about it for a long time. Good luck, everybody.
Yes. Setting the tone. When I was a commander, my detachment, they had a problem with cursing way too much. Over there were two problems. Cursing and flatulence was an issue. Yeah, okay. I had one guy that would like crop dust people. And I was like, bro, this is disgusting. I was like, we're going to have a jar. If you crop dust, this is $5. Seriously, go do it in your office. Close the door. We can't have.
Again, yeah. Like, seriously.
Seriously, with crop dust. And he would laugh about it.
You are in the adolescent. And I keep saying boys, and I'm always so careful not to like make gender generalizations, but honestly,
I will say 95% of the times it was a male.
And then the rest of the time it was you?
Yes.
Oh my gosh. The impression that we are giving of our professional military right now. But hey, you know what? We have our serious side. We do have our very serious side.
Right. Because I mean, there's times that, you know, the job and the mission are serious. People get hurt. Things happen. And it's serious a lot. So you have to find a way to decompress and, you know, why not? Did someone just come in your office?
My daughter just came to the door and I have glass doors and she's like this. Like, get out of here.
You had that mom look like when my son, like I looked up because I thought the kid was opening the door and I would have been like, no, nope. I would have just shook my head and been like, gone the other way.
Well, speaking of which, this family thing. So, yes. And you talk all about this in the book, but you've got, you know, you met your husband. I love that story, by the way that you guys met. And then it's waited a lot. It's creepy. How's that creepy?
It's not creepy. We met online. People I know. Do it now. We set the tone before all this, you know, all this other app. Online Tinder and I don't remember.
Yeah. You know. And then you waited several years to have children and had your first. So how did that change your career attitude and like how you looked at the world?
So my son, I mean, I tell a funny story that I was interested, you know, at one point I had to wrap my mind around the fact that I could not be selfish anymore. Right. So I had to say that, all right, if we have a child, you know, priorities have to change. And it took a couple of months to like wrap my mind around it and say, okay, a lot of branches and sequels in my head on how this could flow. Cause you don't know, kids come in and they just do whatever, you know, they have no idea. It's not their fault. So, when he was born, I was in my staff tour and it didn't really affect anything. At that point, two things, I was eligible to retire out of my staff tour. So I would have had 20 years. I would have been coming up on 19, I think, or I was coming up on 19 years. So I knew if I dropped my papers, I would stay the 20 and I could get out. And then, or try to go back to Beale and work in the deputy OG position, which would be the next step for me. And so I said, okay, who's the ops group commander at the time at Beale? And I didn't know him. So he probably tells the story funnier, but I cold dialed him one day. I didn't even send him an email. And I was like, hey, sir, my name's Merrill. I want to work for you. But he tells it the more longer story that, you know, I was kind of like, I told him like, just ask the people around who I am. Or I did something crazy.
Google me? Did you say Google me?
It wasn't quite Google me, but I was like, sir. And he's like, who are you? And I go, well, sir, I'll send you my resume. But, you know, you can ask the squadron members. I'm Merrill.
Everybody knows me.
And he did. And he's like, oh, yeah.
The Notorious.
Yeah, Notorious. He's like, yeah, come work for me. I'm like, yes. That's why I stayed. So every time, you know, I made a decision, I was like, okay, I need to be ready. If something happens that is going to affect my son, that I'm ready to leave. You know, I had to have that mindset. Like, it couldn't be a surprise. And none of the things that happened were a surprise. I mean, when I got the 365 orders, I knew they were coming. I knew it was my turn in the hopper, but I knew depending on where it was, where it would be, how long that it might generate retirement. So, and it did. So, for my son being there, it just changed my priorities. Especially at a younger age for me, I just wanted to be there to raise him and help raise him and give him input. Can you imagine my husband giving the most input into my son? Oh, no.
I don't know him. But in my house, that happened a lot. So it depends on the guy, I think.
Yeah, no, my husband's awesome. He's good. He's a good guy. He always gets mad at me. I give him a hard time. But yeah, the reason why I decided when I got the orders was because my husband was still doing his reserve stuff. And, you know, there was going to be some lapse in who was watching Flynn. So I was like, yeah. No, I can't have that.
Yeah.
And I thought about it this way. My mom worked as a single parent to give me everything. And now I'm here and I have a lot more and I'm able to give that to my son. I would do my mom a disservice if I didn't, you know, take care of my kids. So that's how I felt about that. And it made the decision easy and it made it easy to walk away.
Well, yeah. You know, again, not that this is about me, it's about you, but to just offer like another perspective or a different experience for people who, you know, are going through their careers or in the military and making choices. I had sort of the opposite experience because I was surprised very early on by being pregnant, and I made the choice, and it was a conscious choice. I considered my options and I had the baby. So I was a junior enlisted person with baby. So I was in the Coast Guard for 28 years and I was a mother for 26 of those. And early on, the choices that I was making, I was separated from my son, but in the way maybe that your mom looked at things, like I was making sacrifices to make his life better.
Right.
I wanted to make sure that I could provide for him and advance. And so it felt like it was soul crushing. Cause I went to sea with baby at home. You know, after he was a year old, I went back to sea and that was really, really hard. And I felt guilty about that forever, but now he's in the Coast Guard and he's at sea. So he turned out okay, you know, but so as I progressed and I got more senior, I, you know, when I was junior and I was going along, my primary focus was providing for him and making the best life that I could for him. And so I could look him in the face, you know, and say, you know, we got to move again, but this is for you. You know, I'm doing this for us, for a family. And then as I got more senior and my husband got more established in his career, it got harder and harder to be like, hey, this is really for you and not right. for me and my ego, you know? So.
Right. Yeah. So we, you know, I had Flynn at 41. So I was already at that point. And that's why I said, look, you know, I say at the end, to what end can I stay in the military? I can stay in the military till I make one star, get passed over or do whatever. And, you know, that's a choice. I mean, I think every woman has to make that choice at the end. I have friends that have left their kids 6 months after for deployment or like you. And it's hard. I'm glad that I was in that position. I don't know if I had Flynn, you know, I would have tried not to have a child while I was flying because in the U-2, you can't be.
Yeah.
Once you're pregnant. Well, yeah. Right. That's a different aircraft. So
I did twice. Option. So.
But some people, like if they're flying tankers and stuff, they could fly till second trimester, keep going, which I think is awesome. But
yeah, for us, it was third trimester.
Was it?
In the helicopter. Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah. Can you imagine?
I flew till 5.5 months with my daughter. I did not fly with my son because I was an elder pregnancy high risk because I was high 40. Because I was 40.
Why are we high risk? I was like in the best shape of my life. I was doing half marathons. Like it was nothing.
I had had some miscarriages too. So.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I had that in my mind, but I got pregnant very quickly. I was like, oh, yeah.
Yeah. Happens with me too. Yeah.
What?
Happens with me too.
I was like, I want to be a teenager. What is this? Anyway. So yeah, that's, that's what I thought. So, I mean, I'm glad I did it the way I did.
Yeah. And it sounds like, so you went on to retire and start personal training. And I, you know, we've talked about it and I quoted you in the article that I wrote about you, that it affords you the opportunity to have the flexibility to be with your kids and still be able to work and inspire and mentor people. Talk a little bit about that.
Right. So, you know, coming up on retirement, when I had my son, I actually got my first certification in training when I was on maternity leave. So, you know, I don't know, I had 2 or 3 months off. So I got my certification via AFA, which I was already thinking about training people. Matter of fact, I was training one of the people in my office. We'd go down to the gym and I'd train him, and I was working with him and all that stuff. And I always wanted to, I don't know why I wanted to do it, because one, I like the workout aspect. I like to understand people. Working out with someone on a physical level makes them, it's almost like it becomes this mental mind-body connection with that person, because you're making them tired, and then they start to open up about stuff, and then they start to think about things, and I'm able to get more to them on a psychological level to help them get their goals or attain other goals. So, I mean, I work out with some people who want to join the military and they want to have better push-ups, or they want to have better pull-ups if they're joining the Marine Corps. So I'm able to do that with people. And it was, I don't know, there's something satisfying for me to watch someone else be successful in what they want to do and their journey. I don't know why. It's, I know, it gives me a little dopamine high. I don't know what it is. It just, it's good. I found that more, I found that better than just flying for Southwest or American. You know, it's great money, but I think the job satisfaction wasn't going to be there. And I was in a position that I was retired. My husband's still working. You know, my son, when I retired, was 4. I could take him to school. I can participate in some of the school activities if I had to be forced. And, you know, I could be there. Yeah, I'm not a big fan of that. Like,
I volunteer at the library because I'm a book girl.
Really?
That's it.
Yeah, there's a lot of tiger moms here where we live because they want their kids to be the best. But I am so, like, I want my kids to socialize with other kids. I do not want to see the drama. And, yeah, I've had this. All right, I'll give you another story. This is a recent one. I won't get into the, it was right after my, did we talk about that one?
Yep. Yeah, we got that one. The colonoscopy we got that one. Okay. Yeah. Where you put your daughter up. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I'm still upset about that. Like, I'm still like, why of all days? So. She's a lot better this week.
Oh, it's a constant evolution.
Yeah. So they always ask for a lot of parents' participation with their kids. And I'm like, no, I send them to school. Let them learn. Let my daughter. Okay. She finds another friend and she shuns her other friend. And then she starts drama. She's upset. I'm like, fix your hot mess. I'm not doing it for you. Bye. And she,
So you fostered her and then adopted her. Tell me about that day for you guys.
So that day, fostering, fostering is, it has a lot of challenges. You have a lot of people in your house. There's a lot of nitpicking about what you do, and you get a little frustrated because it's almost like, hey, we have a kid here that's doing pretty well. We're not the most perfect parents, but could you please stop telling us to do X, Y, and Z, or we need to do this? And now, don't get me wrong, children in the foster care system, they're children of trauma. So they develop differently. You know, there's a whole bunch of data about how their brain patterns work and all that. And we learned that. But my husband and I are very methodical in our approach. You know, we're military people. We set boundaries. We can be disciplinaries, but we also observe and look at things and watch how things trigger and that. So I think with social workers, you know, they have this one can SOP, like, you must follow this path. And we're like, no, that doesn't make sense. Like, and so with us, I think that caused a lot of friction. So, however, she was improving with her attitude. You know, she was a child when we first got her. She'd have math problems, 20 math problems, like 5 + 3. And, you know, addition below 10. And she would throw a tantrum for like 2 hours. 2 hours. And we'd sit there, we'd work with her. And then when she finally did the work, it would take 2 minutes.
I have one of those, by the way.
I was like, what? So we'd go through this, but, you know, I will tell you now, between when we first got her, you know, month zero, month one, to now, you know, 14 months in, I mean, she's in school, she's doing her homework, she's checking her homework. You know, she's smart. She's really, really smart. And she's smart beyond the skills, the survival skills that she had, manipulation, deception, lying, all that stuff. And she's understanding that there's more rewards if you go, not be lazy about it, if you're going the right way. So you know, we have a long way to go, but she's improved. So to answer the question, the adoption day was awesome because it was right before her birthday. It was in person, so we were able to, you know, go and see it, and we kind of made it a special day for her. And it was also the day that I didn't have to see another social worker again. So I was really happy about that. I was like, yeah, get out of my house. I don't have to see a lawyer. I don't have to see a court appointed special agent. I don't have to see social worker A, B, C, and D. Bye. Like, we all had a great relationship, but it was a lot. It was a lot. And so
it's like having the IG in your house every day.
Yeah, it's like doing an audit. You know, it's like doing an audit 3 times a month. It was exhausting, but it was worth it. You know, she's a great kid. She was a kid that went from not wanting to be a doctor because it was too hard to now wanting to be a vet. You know, she does jujitsu. She's taking piano lessons. She does swim lessons. She's excited to be on the swim team. Like, this is a kid now that sees a future. And before, you know, she was just trying to get through day to day. So it's kind of nice.
Well, that's great. I think it's wonderful. I have a good friend who, my writing partner, her name is also Liz. We all have these friends named Liz. She and her partner have fostered 26 children, and they have adopted 3 that they've had for many years. So I know they would identify with some of the challenges that you went through. And it feels like it really kind of all ties into sort of what you're trying to do with this book. You know, it all seems to fit your life mission really neatly. What is your vision for, I mean, I think you said at the end of the book that you, some of the proceeds from the book go to charity. You talk [S2] Yes. [S1] About wanting to help kids get out of whatever rut that they're in. So what's your vision for how to execute that?
So the vision, I mean, yeah, I want to mentor people. I want to walk the talk, right? So people, especially during COVID, I mean, a lot of people went into foster care. A lot of bad things came out when people were isolated, right? So I just want to show kids, young folks who think that they have no future, that there is a possible future. There's different ways that you can go about doing that. Just because you were dealt a bad hand, or just because you came from the Bronx or you came from this family, doesn't mean you can't be amazing and you can't be awesome and you can't fly what you want. You can't be an astronaut in the stars. You can't do a reality show, or you can't be a singer or do whatever. Right. So, I want to show that, and I want to show, you know, people say, oh, we need to help and we need to do this and that. Okay. So, all right, you want to help kids? All right. We foster to adopt. It was a pain in the butt system, but we did it. Now, what are you going to do? You're going to keep talking about it, or you're going to do something? And I'm not saying, look, fostering is not for everyone. Adoption is not for everyone. But big brother and big sister could be for some, right? You could reach, you could do another program. You can, you know, my proceeds go to Legacy Flight Academy. You can be involved in, if you're a pilot, flying, you know, kids out in Compton or in other places in Sacramento, and take them on a flight and change their perspective about how they can live and how they could grow up. So what little thing can you do? You know, if you have that one grain of sand in life and the hourglass of life, what are you going to do with it? So that's what I'm trying to do.
That's great. You mentioned being on a reality TV series, which we haven't talked about yet. And, you know, there are lots of great interviews. I guess I jumped in on one that you were doing with Phil Keegan, and I don't know if that's recorded for people to watch anywhere, but he has such lovely things to say about you and working with you. I always love to see that. I enjoyed watching. I don't do normal TV usually, but when I found out that you were going to be on the show, you know, I was texting you too, because I was an hour ahead of you and you were like, what happened? And I'm like, I'm like, oops, I didn't know she didn't watch it. So
it's okay. It was interesting to see how they edited the show and what they picked on. So I was like, oh, okay. All right. They did a good editing job. So They portrayed everyone very well. And I think Phil and Louise Kogan are phenomenal people.
Oh, I said his name wrong. Kogan. Sorry.
Oh, I'm just, it might, good. Well, yeah. So they're phenomenal. They're phenomenal folks. They were true when they said, look, you're here because you have this story. You're in great shape. You represent America and you have these inspirational stories and we want to share it. And, you know, when you see other reality shows like Joe Millionaire or Love Island, it's a lot of drama. So going into this, I was a little nervous because I was like, man, I'm trying to build something and I'm trying to represent. And if I don't act right, this could ruin me. So.
Yeah. Well, so how did you take that into consideration?
You just want to represent yourself in a good way. So when we're being filmed, I mean, it's a long day. We're mic'd up the whole time. They hear everything that you say. So I had to conduct myself in a way that reflected well, good order and discipline. For myself, because that's, you know, most of the time that's how it is, but you're in a situation where it's physically demanding, you're exhausted, it's highly emotional, and you have to show some restraint, right? So, but there's times that, you know, I don't want to say it is what it is, but sometimes you just let it out. And I did. I don't know. There were times I was frustrated. They did not. I don't think they posted any of that. They did show the fact about my road rage, which I was like, really? When I was driving.
Yeah.
And I would have all these comments. I'm a New Yorker. There's some things I could change. Like I would. Yeah, I was.
I was driving rage.
It wasn't.
It was just normal, you know, monologuing about the traffic.
Yeah, my inner monologue was coming out. But I was in LA. I was used to driving in LA, living in Palmdale, and they're so annoying. Driving in California like that, they're so annoying.
I know.
It frustrates me so much.
That's so funny.
It's like that was the only place I could control myself.
That's so funny. Man,
but I just said, Meryl, be yourself and be who you are, and I lived up to that.
Yeah, well, it was really fun getting to know you through that, and watching you, like, where you started and going through it and just all of the dynamics. And you're right. That show was lovely because it wasn't a whole lot of drama, you know, artificially created interpersonal drama. It was people under pressure trying to, you know, and your true character, I think, I mean, I can't imagine anybody who could go through that, that their true character didn't reveal itself at some point in the show. How long was the filming?
I can't tell you exactly how long, but it was several weeks.
I was trying to put it in the context of like an officer candidate school or a boot camp. Like, how does it compare? Because it feels like that kind of environment, you know, a little bit.
So it's probably as long as boot camp. And it was, I mean, every day we were competing. So it was, it was like hard labor every day. Cause these, you know, they condense everything into 1 hour and that's with dialogue and getting to know people. But I mean, seriously, some of our events took 2-3 hours.
Yeah.
And it was, I remember the slime eel challenge. One, I was so angry. I was like, I was mad at Phil. I was like, seriously. I was like, bro, this is gross. When he pulled it out, like at first he put his hand in the bucket and then he did this and he pulled it out. I was like, what is that? Like in my mind, I was like, Meryl, don't freak out. Don't freak out on camera. Don't freak out on camera. No. Okay. Just look and how we're going to deal with this. Like in my head. And we touched it and I'm like, okay, it doesn't feel that bad. But this is gross. And then when we saw the bins and where we had to run back and forth, I looked in the bin and in my mind, I'm like, there's about 300 of these things in here, 300 to 400. I said, oh my gosh. I was like, if I get, like in my mind, I was calculating, I was like, if I get 10 in at a time and we're running back and forth, this is about, I was like, this is about a, you know, quarter mile. I said, oh my gosh. We're doing like 3 miles of running and walking to the back and forth. Like I was like, okay, this is a game of endurance, just marathon, not sprint. Like in your mind, this is what I was doing, calculating.
It was a pretty gross. I thought that was funny that one got you though too. Like, I don't know. Cause there were, you have a lot of interesting things. I don't know. I guess that probably was the grossest one though.
It was the grossest because of the slime, and they gave us these little bags to put them in, and they were like, you can't kill them, because my first thought was like, I will bludgeon them to death and then just put as many in. And they were like, you can't leave them on the ground, you can't step on them. I'm like, they're like, PETA will be mad. I'm like, it was disgusting. I mean, it wasn't that disgusting to me. I mean, I had them in my shirt. So, So Phil looked at me. He's like, I'm like, well, it's gameplay. There we go.
Yeah.
Gotta get it done.
Did the experience like really affect your life? You know, now you've had plenty of time to reflect on that at this point.
I did. How did it? Well, first of all, it got my story out to so many people, and I'm forever grateful to the show for that. The experience was so intense. I mean, I'm still, it brought back memories of being in the military, going out, whether it's in the Navy on a deployment with my debt or going out flying U-2s with a group of guys. It was intense in that way where you form these tight bonds so quickly because you have this shared experience. So it was very nostalgic to me, especially after being out of the military for, you know, about 18 months. It's, you know, the assimilation back into civilian life as a military person can be difficult. You just have a way of thinking, and now you get back to where people are kind of, there's no definitive yes, no. It's like, well, maybe, or I'll get back to you whenever.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things that makes you grit your teeth because it's not the norm. And you want to choke you straight up want to choke people out. Like when I'm when I'm working, I mean, I'm be honest, I work at a gym and people just can't even be on time. And then I watch management and I watch how management treats people and I watch the things they say. And in my mind, I have to walk away because the colonel is like trying to come out like there would like an exorcism would have to happen because I want to spin my head because I'm like, I cannot believe you just said that to that individual. I can't believe you talked to them that way. And I can't believe you're a grown adult older than me doing that to someone else.
Yeah,
that's so that's a hard transition. And I think in some cases you when you're in the military, you have this mission, you have this focus, and now that's gone. And that can also be a little bit hard to manage, kind of daunting.
It's disorienting a little, right?
Yes, it's disorienting. You get some spatial D, right?
Yeah.
Because you're not sure which way is up. You're not sure if you're going the right way. You're not sure if you're going to get the job. You're not sure why they think of you this way. That like civilians are not forthright with you, right? In a way. Yeah. And then you have to, there's a lot of drama that's surrounding it and you just don't understand. So doing the show kind of just was, you know, put a lot of things in perspective for me in terms of, yeah, there are people out there who work hard, bust their butt, are emotional, but they're very focused and they want to do things. So that gave me some hope. Like, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I could see that, especially with that crew of people for sure.
Yeah. I was able to take a deep breath and go, okay, everyone out here is not cray cray. Who's not a non-military person. Like that first year was tough. I mean, there was just days I would just sit, like I work out and I would just sit on my bench just thinking like, is this it? Is this all life is?
Yeah.
And I'm sure people have thought about that, but yeah.
Yeah. That's a really interesting perspective. The way that we process our military experience when you've been in as long as you were, as long as I was, it's an evolution for sure. And then when you think about people coming back from combat tours and how, you know, abrupt it is to be immersed in a totally new environment and try to adjust to that.
You know, yeah.
So if it was hard for you or hard for me, you know, yeah.
Yeah. Imagine, you know, yeah. Imagine the person coming back from their fifth combat tour.
Right.
Nothing makes sense.
Right.
Like nothing makes sense. And then you start to doubt, I would think you'd start to doubt everything, even your own existence. Like why? So, it's hard. I mean, yeah, it's tough.
Yeah. Well, you seem to be finding ways to navigate it. And I am too, you know. So the next thing that I'd like to talk to you about, and we have been talking forever. And so if you need a break, please take one and then I'll do some edits to this. So I am going to split this up. I want to talk a little bit about the actual production of the book, for people who, haven't, you know, who don't necessarily want to write and publish one themselves, but who need a little help with that. And I want to make sure that they have examples like you, but for me, like I retired to write full time. I enjoy writing. I love it, but it's very isolating. And in the year of the COVID and the writing, I was able to kind of connect with what were the things that I was missing from being on active duty. Because I don't miss everything. Right. I really don't. I do enjoy having my freedom. I do enjoy not, you know, working for organizations that give me no resources and expect the world from me. And every day I'm making choices about how to fail. Like, I don't miss that, you know?
Absolutely.
I like having some command of my own life and my own time and being able to make decisions about how I use it. But I missed mentoring, networking, helping people connect people with, you know, not just where they knew they wanted to go, but ideas that maybe they didn't even think about that were possible for them. You know, I loved that part of being in leadership is like, you know, helping people connect the dots, because that's what people did for me. When I enlisted, I never imagined I was going to go to officer candidate school, go to flight school, go to Harvard, like never go be the senior defense official in a foreign country. Like none of those things were even, flying was my dream, but none of those other things were. And so the point is that I missed that being able to be that for somebody else to help connect them to their opportunities that are available. And so I've been able to like combine this flying thing, which I love, and the writing thing into something that I think will just keep me busy for the rest of my life, you know, and allow me to do some of that stuff. So,
yeah. So I agree with you. So yes, I miss the flying, but I could do commercially, yeah. Just privately. I like the mentorship because I get to do it. I don't miss, hey, you're getting ready for deployment. Your UDM unit, unit deployment manager, you need to do anti-terrorism training and this training. And you need to, what else? You need to make sure that your CAC card won't expire because you haven't done your cyber stuff.
Oh, all the fun stuff.
Yeah, I don't miss that. But yeah, you're right. In the civilian world, what I love is that I could translate a lot of my military experience to here. And, you know, when we network with people and we say we're going to call and be on time, we're going to call and be on time.
Yeah,
we're going to give them a product. They're like, holy cow, what is this? Yes. When right. I have to do if I have to do a PowerPoint presentation for presenting to some people, and I do, and they go, wow, that's really good. Yeah, well, because I've been PowerPointing for over 20 years. So professional. Yes. A lot of intel briefs.
Yes.
So now that, yeah, so there is definitely a lot of silver linings in it.
Yeah.
But
thank you so much for taking the time with me. We took a lot of time, but I've been really excited about this and you have so much to offer. So thank you.
Oh, well, thank you for having me and listening to me. I hope people learn some stuff from it or learn a little bit more about me.
Thanks so much for listening and for joining in the discussions in the Aviatrix Book Club. Please join us next month when we will discuss the book A Pair of Wings, which is an historical fiction novel based on the life of Bessie Coleman by Carol Hobson, who I have already interviewed, so you can check out her interview on the Aviatrix Book Review website and podcast. Blue skies and happy reading, everyone.